Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pony Sync for the 25th of October, 2017. How's everybody doing? I hope well. Let's have a start by looking at issues. Although, actually, are there pending RFCs we should be going through? Let me have a quick check. I don't think so. I think we don't have pending RFCs. Okay. So let's jump into issues. So 2196 is marked as needs discussion. Expected behavior with regard to tuples and capabilities. So there's been quite a bit of discussion on this over time. And it seems like the last comment was a while ago, but it's still marked as needing discussion. And I think it's because Joe was asking me a question that I haven't responded to. Is this one that we should cover now? Is this good?
Yeah, it's a nice way to start us off, I think.
All right, excellent. So, yeah, I think your table that you've got there, absolutely correct in terms of determining a general tuple type. I think that works quite well, actually. Because basically what it's obeying is what can be. It's equivalent of saying what can go into. Oh, actually, no, because transition is a little bit funny there.
So if you, up at the top of the comment, basically Benoit came up with this rule of the capability of the tuple is the capability which sees the set of element capabilities as themselves.
So this is problematic for transition, funnily enough. Because for transition, if the tuple itself is transition, there's some idea that that could then be frozen, but you can't freeze it because it has a box and there might be a ref alias to that box element. And once again, I'm reminded that I think tuples being of a separate kind to objects is problematic, and that tuples should probably just have a top-level capability on them and be treated as an anonymous record in every conceivable way. So I think if there's any box in it, it can't be transition, because the transition can decay to val. And then that would be problematic. But I think that table, other than that, works. It's just that box can't be in the set for transition.
Now, does ISO have a similar issue that we encounter?
It would, except that it has exactly the things in it that work, I think. Tag val and ISO, which are the things that can go into it, that can be put into something isolated. In the same way, so each of these is an interesting combination of what can be read out of it and what can be put into it. If that makes any sense. Safe to write and viewpoint adaptation.
Yeah. Okay. So if we take box out of the tran row, what is there a is there like a general rule we can use that gets applied to justify that, so that we can sum this up as a self-contained rule? I mean, we already have tag as the edge case in that rule because tag doesn't have any viewpoint adaptation.
Yeah. Indeed. It's very interesting. I'm not sure what the general rule is. It is equivalent to safe to write for the mutable types. For the immutable types, obviously nothing is safe to write, and so the rule isn't the same.
So what's the summary of the safe to write rule?
That's an excellent question. So safe to write is the set of capabilities, the set of RCAPs that can be written to a field of the origin without violating local compatibility. So if you put a ref inside an ISO, then we have the idea that ISO to ref for local compatibility yields an ISO. In fact, eventually in the compiler we'll change it so that for viewpoint adaptation it yields an ISO. And ISO is not locally compatible with ref, so it's not safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's the set of operations that won't violate well-formed visibility. Ah, which means that this is indeed a well-formed the whole thing is a well-formed visibility problem. That's exactly what this is.
Right.
And I think that tells us that tag shouldn't be an exception. That it's there is no tag tuple type because you can always read the fields of tuples. And that if everything is tagged, that's fine. That's a val. That's a val tuple. Which makes sense, right? It's a value type. You can copy that anywhere you want, share it everywhere you want.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. So, all right. So is there any way we can be sure that these are the only two changes that need to happen to that table before proceeding?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Some kind of mechanical, rule that can be applied for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Off the top of my head, this seems like there's a split between the mutable and the immutable types, and that seems wrong. Yeah. Ah. So, sorry, I'm being a little bit slow here. I apologize, but I think maybe it's that your original observation is correct. It's just combined with the safe to write rule.
Okay.
Is that it?
if like a union with the safe to right rule or an intersection?
It's an intersection with the safe to right rule.
Okay.
Yeah.
Except for you can't apply the safe to right rule to immutable types. Right. You just skip it in that case.
And you just skip it in that case.
Okay.
So it's a little bit awkward as a formulation, but I think still your observation is still right.
Well, Benoit's observation.
Sorry. Benoit's observation is still right.
I just wanted to make sure that you got credit for that. Okay, let me...
I don't remember thinking about that anyway, so...
The credit's all mine!
Woo!
Okay, so I'm removing the tag case. I'm removing box from the tran case. And I'm going to do a little summary of your described rule. Okay. I should add to this comment.
Yeah, I think that's it. Sorry, I'm just going over some of the tables. Also, Paul came up with a new formulation for well-formed visibility. It's pretty exciting. It's vastly simpler. Is correct for every scenario while being a three-case rule, which is pretty neat. And will make a mechanical proof a lot easier, which is cool.
Is that in his paper?
No, I mean, he literally came up with it in a conversation with Sophia last week.
Awesome.
I have some handwritten notes about it that I've been looking at, and so it's just brand new stuff.
Exciting. Yeah, I would like to eventually have somewhere in the compiler, either in PonyC or in PonyCC or both, have a mechanism for testing the type system functions, based on, some mechanical rules like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this gives us a much better shot at that. So Paul's cock proof became difficult to finish because of well-formed visibility. I think this is going to make a really big difference. If I've understood that right, I might have the precise things wrong, but I believe that was the primary problem. And this makes the third version of well-formed visibility. My first formulation, George Steed's formulation, and now Paul's. So this is great.
Yeah, and I still also want to eventually work in George Steed's viewpoint adaptation changes as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think the distinction between read and extract should go all through the compiler.
Yeah, and even without that distinction, there were some cases that he found out could be allowed that we weren't allowing already.
Exactly, particularly that ISO to ref should yield ISO scenario.
Yeah, that one that was blocking the change that Sean really wanted to do to the TCP connection that lets you pass in a enhance the notify system with a type parameter.
Ah, yeah.
Because then you can do ISO arrow type param and you come out with the ISO type for it if the type parameter is ref.
Which is perfect, exactly. Okay, cool. Okay, so I'm going to backtrack slightly and go to PRs. I realize that I totally forgot to do them. And the first one is 2295, the D-trace probes. This comes from Scott, which is cool. And I'm not sure why this is marked. I mean, other than there seems to have been a problem with the AppVeyor build, which I'm not sure that should have died. It looks like a spurious failure on the Windows 3.8.1, LLVM 3.8.1 release build. So that's a bit meh.
Yeah, it's spurious. It's just failed to download a file.
Yeah, exactly. Let me see if I can restart just that one and get a nice clean text. But other than that, I'm not really sure why this is marked as needs discussion. Does anyone know?
So I don't know why Sean marked that in discussion.
Okay.
But I'm personally a bit worried that this change could degrade performances when we're building without D-trace, since it's adding us some parameters to, for example, the
to push it
functions.
Yeah.
So I think doing a benchmark of that change on the non-D-trace build before merging would be good.
Okay, cool. Can you make a comment based on that?
Yes, I'll do that.
Awesome, thank you. As I completely fail to figure out or remember or whatever it is, how to restart an AppVeyor job, because apparently... There you go. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I think it would be a little bit filthy in terms of the ifdefs, but in no way impossible to ifdef out needing the extra parameters when it's not D-trace. So I think it could be done to leave those out in a non-D-trace build.
Yeah, we could do that also.
Yeah. All right. All right, cool. The other one that is marked needs discussion is 2264, generalized runtime back pressure, which is still marked do not merge, because I think Sean is still doing some performance testing on it, as I understand it. But in general, I've been through this in pretty close detail, and it looks really very good. Is anyone concerned about it?
No, my main concern that I kind of brought up with Sean and IRC earlier last week was, at that time, it didn't have any capability object that needed that you needed to be able to do it, and that seemed kind of dangerous to me to be able to invoke the back pressure primitive from anywhere.
Right, because you can just
add that. So that was my main concern.
A good concern, because then you just start arbitrarily backing things up and nobody realizes that you've arbitrarily put pressure on things. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, I guess there's also an education aspect, we'll need some kind of guidelines, best practices or whatever about about when it's appropriate to put on back pressure and when it's not.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part is once we have back pressure in the standard library in useful places, which mostly is TCP and process monitor, possibly standard out, although no, because standard out isn't going to realize it's back pressured. It's just going to run slow, and then things are going to back pressure based on that. So mostly TCP and process monitor, because process monitor can, you can have that same TCP like thing where, oh, there's, I can't really write to this thing. I suspect there shouldn't be too many other places where programmers should need to add back pressure by hand.
Yeah, that's probably right. And that would be ideal, obviously. Maybe it doesn't need that much in terms of like design patterns. Most people aren't going to be copying the TCP connection like Sendence did.
Like certain
people. Labs.
Yeah.
And they won't have to anymore either once we get that type parameterization, the notify thing in place. But I digress. Anyway, do you think the UDP should have back pressure too, just to start dropping data grams instead of flooding your application?
So the back pressure would come on write, and UDP doesn't know, right? So UDP just fires it off and goes, well, we're done here. We've dropped
oh,
it.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
And so on read, it will get back pressured because it starts spamming your nodes and they can't keep up. And then you will get, it will be muted. And then it'll
right. The recipient.
Right. So if this all works as it's supposed to, and so far it really seems to, which is really cool. UDP, it seems like right now, won't need explicit back pressure. I'm probably missing something, but.
No, that sounds right to me. I forgot that it would be on the receiving end and not on the.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so it's really all about the write stuff, because at the read level, right, you'll pick it up from the generalized back pressure. Part of the reason I'm very excited about this is that I once told Sean a long time ago that if he ever figured out how to do this, he'd have to write a paper about it. So I'm really hoping that I can now badger him into writing a paper about it.
Yeah. at least a blog post, right?
No, I totally want a paper. I want a paper. But yeah, probably just a blog post. We'll see. So this is pretty exciting for me. All right, cool. So actually, Joe, maybe actually the documentation needs to be exactly the conversation we just had, which is here's why it isn't necessary in a lot of the cases you might think it would be, and this is why, hey, programmer, we hope you never need to touch this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there should be something written about that.
Okay, cool. Do you want to make a note in the PR about that maybe that's the sort of documentation it needs?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Okay, cool. I think then maybe we can have our midpoint moment slightly early of is there stuff that people want to bring up?
Yes, I do have something.
Excellent.
I'm working on a separate compilation currently.
That's
with the method that I'm trying to implement is basically to treat everything in the package as reachable and to emit the code for every function in a separate LLVM modules. And one thing that I'm not sure how we want to handle is a generic function and verification.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we should take the Java approach and use a single generic implementation for every instance of a generic function, or if we should take the C++ approach and keep the AST somewhere in the compiled package and generate the verifications as needed. So I'm wondering if anyone has thought on that.
Personally, I have a strong preference for the second approach. And there are several reasons for that. One is that the first implies type erasure, which means that if anything took a primitive as an argument, it would always be boxed. And it's a very serious performance problem for languages that do that, primarily Java. And the other is that even for situations where it isn't a primitive, you lose all your possibilities for inlining, which is one of the main reasons to do, well, no, it is amongst the many lovely reasons to do polymorphic functions. So I would definitely prefer the second approach. Does anyone else have any feelings on that? And it's the hardest part about separate compilation by far. Well, I mean, the same applies to classes, right? When you have generic classes and you don't know how it's going to be instantiated, we want the same kinds of rules about being able to instantiate over a primitive and getting non-boxed primitives.
Okay, so my thought on that and was that I'd like to keep the current strategy of call program compilation for builds that require maximum performance.
Okay.
And maybe have a separate compilation be the fast build time for development build way to compile a program.
Okay.
So that's why I'm. I'm still interested in trying the Java approach.
Okay.
Or maybe we could do both. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense to me. I mean, when you're developing, at least you know, I'm used to really fast feedback loops, and the speed of compilation is way more important to me than the speed of the program in general when developing. And then when you do a production build, it's like the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's very much the case already with existing ahead of time compilers, right? Like, I don't know. I just happen to have been doing a lot of work with atomic operations on various compilers at the moment. And boy, yeah, debug builds and atomic operations on the Microsoft C++ compiler are pretty horrific. But it's nice for the speed of compilation. That's a really good point. Are you concerned about boxing being so much of an... no, I guess it's the same issue, isn't it? The boxing is the same issue. Okay, yeah. Why not? Let's try it. Let's see what happens.
Okay, so that's all for me.
Okay, cool. So then are you thinking that then when linking these things together, when something is looking for an implementation that is like that is primitives and it's, you know, I don't know, just making stuff up, it's like an III as opposed to an OOO mangled function, that it'll choose the OOO function and insert the boxing calls?
Yeah, that could, yeah, I think that would be the best solution if we take the no reification approach.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Is that going to be problematic for return types? Let's say you've got a function over some type A that is constrained enough that you need to be able to instantiate one?
Yeah, probably. And another thing I've been thinking about is, for example, if you have an array of matching number, for example, if you have a non-verified function that returns something like that, then the number will be boxed inside of the array constructed in the function.
Right.
And the caller would have to have a way to detect whether the number I boxed or not.
That's very interesting. And I suppose exactly the other way too, where if you have one that's unboxed and you pass it in and it believes it's some read seek of A or array of A, yeah. And now it's returning. Maybe what it, oh, that's complex, isn't it? So anything that could return A would need a separate entry point, which is the O entry point for returning that A that would then do the auto boxing.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. That sounds very hard. But not impossible, just requiring much thought and work. So,
yeah. Another solution would be to box everything as soon as it is part of a generic type. But that's the same thing as the trade-off of the program performance and the compilation performance that we're talking about.
Yeah. And it also means that, yeah. Yeah, and then so then you couldn't combine separate compilation of some things and sort of whole program optimization of other things. And that's okay, I suppose. In the sense of you couldn't say, oh, look, here's a library that was pre-compiled and you can use that and it's lower performance, but the rest of your code is high performance. You would have to do all sort of lower performance boxed code. That's okay.
Yeah, maybe the ideal would be to have both solutions. But yeah, that's harder to do.
Yeah. I'm a little nervous to have too many different approaches in the sense of making it unclear what approaches are sort of a good idea or not. And maybe just saying, look, this really is intended for fast edit, compile, run, debug cycle stuff, if that's the goal, then there definitely is no requirement for using a pre-compiled library along with higher performance code that you're compiling in a different pass. And it keeps the purposes separate. I don't know if that's the right purpose, but by cutting down the use cases seems to sort of lower the load on the developer a little. I don't know if that's right or not.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay. All right, cool. All right. I have a thing that I want to ask, but it's kind of putting Joe on the spot, and I'm sorry, Joe, but I'm really curious how things are going on Pony CC.
So this past couple weeks, I've had a lot going on in my personal life. I know that you're no stranger to that as well.
Yeah, sorry about that. Me too.
In particular, I've been doing a lot of home repairs. Anyway.
Ouch.
The current status is that basically what I'm trying to work out is the generalized system for, I'm up to basically, I got all the way up through part of the sugar pass, most of the sugar pass. The issue comes in is I'm trying to sort of realize this vision that I have of compiling things sort of like very much in parallel using by having things like that use a promise-like system to link what they need to do next to the things that they depend on, and then when those things they depend on are ready, the promise-like system gets fulfilled, and they can continue making the rest of the ASD modifications that they are making.
Yeah, that makes sense. So having a promise that wants, say, N things in order to be fulfilled, and then it runs its code.
It's more like to give an example. It's like, say, okay, I need to. I need to like go look up this other type and use it here. Let's say I need to look up this other function. Here's the call site. I just encountered the call site of a function. In order to proceed with the type checking, I need to have a resolved type signature for that function. And so you invoke something that says, okay, when the type signature for this function is resolved, then run this lambda and pass in that type signature that got resolved.
Okay.
And then I can continue with the work I'm doing here, and then that sort of like cascades down into a bunch of other dependencies getting resolved until either you've got like a deadlock and you say, okay, here are my outstanding things that never got resolved, and so you have like a you can present like a compiler error that says, you know, this I can't infer this because this is ambiguous. You have to fill it in either here, here, or here.
Right.
Or, you know, if there's no deadlock, then you completed compiling all the things that you needed to compile. It's sort of like a reachability sort of thing at the same time. Although I think we probably do want to preserve the idea of compiling like type checking all the types, even the ones that aren't reachable. But it's sort of like the reachability is like built into the mechanism. And so I've been going through different iterations of this and trying to make it work with the fact that I also I want AST trees to be shareable. So right now they are persistent collections, which makes the obviously when you're using immutable types, you make the modification of them interesting. So my strategy so far has been that AST trees do not know about their parents like they do in PonySeq.
Mm-hmm.
They're only like, you know, inward or downward facing.
Right.
And that part works out pretty well in terms of making it so that I can like, you know, share a type, you know, like let's say like there's a bunch of different expressions that all have the same type. That means that I can share the same, you know, pointer to an immutable, you know, resolved type for that expression everywhere that it's used.
Yeah,
so it's pretty cool for saving memory.
And also just for conquering a bunch of correctness problems that we've had in PonyC, where ASTs mutate and all of a sudden things were holding on to cached things and all kinds of horrible things happen.
I had those in mind too. So the issue comes in, obviously, when we need to do mutations on these ASTs, and for a persistent collection like this, that means you need to start at the top. Like you need to to replace the top of the tree, all the way up at the root. So I've been experimenting with like the idea of each, like either each module, like each pony source file, or each type, or each package being an actor. And you can send a message to that actor that says, you know, I want to modify this thing, so give me like transactional access to it, and I will modify it and return it to you. And then you do the work of modifying yourself, the rest of the tree above that, to take that into account.
Okay.
So I've been working a little bit with that. It's still not complete, but I kind of like where it's going. But this sort of overarching system is like kind of necessary for me to get past the sugar pass and into the passes where I actually have these like the things that are depending on each other, because the sugar pass is pretty much stateless. It uh-huh. depends on only stuff that's immediately visible to what you're looking at.
Yeah. So I get to do some really horrific name dropping right now, and I apologize. But I was talking to Simon Peyton Jones and Don Syme yesterday on some work that Claudio Russo is doing at work on type classes. Really neat stuff. Type classes for C#. This is public, so it's okay to say it. They were talking about how formulating the type checker as a constraint-solving system can be really powerful for a lot of type inference stuff. And the stuff that you were just talking about right there sounds in some ways like a constraint-solving system, where you're waiting to pick up additional information and until the constraint is tight enough that it's resolved. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's like kind of like the next step in my evolution of this idea, I guess. Beyond just because this definitely did evolve out of like some of my frustrations trying to get lambda inference working in PonyC. In that, I mean, just inference in general. Like you've got a lot of cases where things could get inferred in either direction, so there's no clear answer about which thing you need to type check first. You need to, like, you know, be able to backtrack your steps and all this stuff that gets really hairy. So I liked the idea of a system that was built around decoupling that. So you're not worried about backtracking. You just say, give me this when it's done, and then I'll continue with this lambda. And that's kind of distinct from having to backtrack and keep track of that yourself. And maybe it's already done, maybe it's done later. And then, like I said, you either get deadlock or you get a solution.
That sounds really cool. And extremely useful for not just in the sense of PonyCC working, but in the sense of being able to add more power to the compiler.
That's Although my concern about that is that if we add a bunch of cool features that PonyC doesn't have, then now PonyC isn't compatible with that that new language. But
Here's the thing about better compilers. Better compilers make better languages and vice versa, right? So if we get to that problem, that's a lovely problem to have, right? And then we can worry about it then.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the long answer to what's the status of it. As soon as I have this system in place for the modification of these ASTs that I was talking about, and the, like that resolution of dependencies, I would love to get more people involved with just kind of porting over a bunch of stuff from PonyC if they're interested in doing so. Some people have expressed interest so far, but yeah.
Super cool. All right. Awesome. I would be keen to work on that too.
So would I.
Awesome. Okay, cool. We have about 10 minutes left. Is there anything else that people want to cover? Because if not, I'll jump in and talk nonsense for a little bit. But I want to make sure everyone.
There was one thing I wanted to mention. It's a little bit of a downer. So this issue that we've been kind of batting around with unconstrained types and runtime matching and the fact that the compiler currently allows matching by capability if you're working with an unconstrained type.
Yeah.
I was helping Matthias with his work on getting more errors for exhaustive matches, and if it's exhausted partway through, then the rest of the cases will also raise an error that says, "Hey, this is already exhausted. This case is unreachable." In doing so, I found another spot in the standard library where this unconstrained issue was, or I should say, Matthias found it, and I can confirm that this was the same issue. He thought it was a bug in his code, but it wasn't. So this is PR2289 under files change. Where's that? In packages/iter/tools/iter.pony.
Sorry, excuse me, I'm just getting over to the PRs, 2289.
Yeah, iter.pony. This consume X as A thing was matching on it was matching on capability at runtime, basically.
Bugger.
So it was trying to distinguish between A and A bang at runtime.
Right.
So I just wanted to say that, yeah, like this is, I don't necessarily expect to get a resolution of this today. I just wanted to mention this to bring a few people's attention that this is a problem that could cause correctness errors in people's code, and I'm kind of worried about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Ouch.
Okay. So, what were you going to talk about?
Funnily enough, it's not totally unrelated. So I know I've mentioned that I've been thinking about some GC stuff, and one of the implications is changing a whole bunch of stuff about allocators and GC and even how actor termination works. And the idea is to, as I mentioned before, is to cut down on GC messages and, in fact, get down to the point where there are no GC messages at all, looks like what the current outcome would be. And it means that there's a bunch of sort of metadata overhead that gets kept right now in the form of when actors have their map of actors to objects that are kept in GCT that are for tracking foreign references. And this approach would make all that go away. In fact, it would make actor heaps and actor GCT entirely go away. So you wouldn't have per actor heaps anymore. Instead, every isolated region that an actor happens to be an isolated region could be independently collected. But sort of the interesting flip of this is that while that saves a lot of memory in those areas, it also means that each object would need an additional header word. And it can't be in the descriptor because it's per object what goes into that.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say this is interesting. It reminds me of Do you remember, maybe you already had this in mind, but do you remember Paul had a, Paul Leotard had a comment in one of the, one of our issues, I don't remember which one, about, better, like allowing more, safe cases for like recovery, and whatnot by, by sort of explicitly tracking, isolated regions as a, you know, as at least a compiler level entity, if not a user visible entity.
Exactly. Totally. Yes. This is related to that too. Yeah. And the end result, well, no, amongst the many end results of this system would be, we could actually pattern match on capability completely at runtime. And at first I thought we couldn't because it's path dependent, right? But actually we can, because it turns out path dependent is a way to narrow it, but that doesn't mean you can't pattern match on the underlying capability. For example, if I see something as box, I thought that we had a big problem, because if you pattern match on capability, well, if it's val, that's great, but if it's ref, maybe you shouldn't have ref access to it. But of course you can have ref access to it. It's absolutely fine. Because either the underlying object is ref and you are in the same actor that has ref access to it, in which case it's fine, or it's val, in which case any actor can have access to it and you'll match it as val. And the primary place where this could become problematic would be if you have a tag reference to something. But it turns out that's really easy, because then you know that you have a tag reference to it and you can deny, you can at runtime say that no, you can't get any deeper than that. It's a tag reference, because we have that information available at compile time.
So I think it makes sense in terms of like things that are thread safe. One observation though is that like with the sort of conceptual ties that we give to reference capabilities as being sort of like very much tied in with like capability security. It's interesting that this would allow you to escalate. You could escalate from box to ref just because it was thread safe, even if the owner really only wanted you to have the box, right?
Right, totally. So I love the way you think. This is exactly where I was going on this as the next thing, is that when I realized that, oh, we have tag available, and that's so we can limit it to just tag, I realized that actually that solves sort of all of the runtime capability matching problems, because the problem isn't that we're trying to distinguish for some foo box, whether it's a foo ref or a foo val. The problem comes with union types and trying to distinguish between some foo ref and some bar val, right? Or other strange combinations thereof.
Right.
And I think what we can do is to use the approach of saying tag limits what the runtime is willing to tell you, right? In other words, we actually change the way we do code generation to say, oh, well, we happen to know that this is the type and therefore these are the kinds of matches we can do. I think solves that exact problem. I hope.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so in the case of an algebraic data type, you can generate pattern matching code that is only willing to look so deeply at what the underlying capability is, but based on what the underlying type of the object is. So it says, okay, let's look. Is this a bar? If this is a bar, what's its underlying type? If this is a foo, what's its underlying type? And to sort of structure that in such a way that narrow types are matched first, if that makes any sense. So if bar is an interface, we look for the more specific foo first.
And we'd still be protecting against capability escalation in that case?
Exactly. So that's the part that this was all in aid of, was just to get to exactly the concern that you raised.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, I hope so.
So you say that it implies we'd have an extra bit to the object header?
Yeah, it would be an entire extra. So this approach is an entire extra pointer-sized entry in an object header.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty significant on a per object basis. So if you have right, basically under the current system, if you have many objects shared across actors, this is much cheaper on memory. But if you have almost no objects shared across actors, this is more expensive on memory.
Interesting. Yeah.
So it's not a slam dunk. Or at least not as far as I can tell.
So what would be the, are there any other performance implication in the runtime? For example, in freezing an object graph as immutable in a representation?
Yeah, so when you freeze an object graph, you need to build strongly connected components. And that means, Matt Parkinson and I at work have built a variation of Trajan's algorithm to do this. And basically it's a variation of a two stack strongly connected components finding algorithm that also builds the reference count as you go, which is really good. That makes it much cheaper. It means there's only one trace through the object graph on freeze. So it turns out that the cost is to build those strongly connected components is about the same as sending an isolated graph and a message. So, but it only needs to be done once in order to turn it immutable. So there is a cost to do it, but the cost is sort of like a send trace, if that makes any sense.
Okay. So, if I understand correctly, the new additional field in the object is a reference count, or is it something else?
It depends. It's many things. So, for mutable objects, it's part of a cyclic linked list to keep track of an isolated region. If it's an immutable object, it's either a reference count, or if the object is in a strongly connected component, it's a pointer to the lead object in the SCC that holds the reference count. There's some other things that go in there as well. Sorry, I'm being a little bit vague because until it goes public, properly public, like I'm just not sure what's going to happen with it on the work side. It will go public. It's just, I have to be a little bit vague on the way. Sorry about that. And then there's some... There's an additional performance implication that I want to make sure I mention, which is that we don't want to manipulate those reference counts when we do operations where we're changing fields that point to immutables, but not adding an immutable to a new into an isolated region that didn't point at it before. So one of the big advantages of the current system is that it. Reference counts don't depend on the shape of the heap, right? It just depends on how things have been sent. So each isolated region would keep a remembered set of what immutable things are accessible from that isolated region. And so having more than one pointer to that thing would not change the reference count. And if you moved it around and assigned it here and assigned it there, it wouldn't change the reference count. So you want to get rid of all those, as many atomic reference count operations as you possibly can, and that this basically gets rid of a huge chunk of them. And essentially, you only have one when an isolated region receives a reference to an immutable, whether that's in a message to an actor or putting one into an ISO object or something like that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All right. Cool. Awesome. Horrifically. And I sort of feel like I shouldn't say this in public, because I don't want anyone to do this, but it would open up the possibility to handle all reference capability stuff dynamically instead of statically. Let's not do that.
Yeah, that's no fun.
First of all, no fun and expensive, right? It'll just slow everything down. But
I mean, this was one of the things that really drew me into Pony. I was like, wait, that's all done ahead of time. Like that was one of the things that really sold me on the language. So I don't want to lose that along the way.
Oh God, no! Like I really mean it. Let's just never ever do that. I just felt like, since I'm telling you about it, I should admit that it would be possible. But it's a terrible idea. All right. I'm afraid we're at the end of time. Although if people have something they want to bring up, I'm happy to go over. Is there anything else we should go over? All right, cool. Next week, I might bore you on how this proposed system might interact with tags and with collecting actors, because I'm really keen to get you guys' input on some of that, because yeah, some complications there. Anyway, thank you everybody for a fabulous conversation as usual, and I'm gonna hit stop record. Bye y'all.